I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Bruce Post. Bruce S. Post, a 1969 Norwich graduate, has worked for several members of the Vermont and other congressional delegations. He was chief of staff for U.S. Representative John B. Anderson during Anderson's 1980 presidential campaign, and also served as a researcher and speechwriter for U.S. Senator Hubert H. Humphrey in the 1972 Democratic presidential primaries. As Vermont Governor Richard Snelling's Director of Planning and Research, Bruce developed a comprehensive perspective on multiple issues facing Vermont. He now writes and lectures on Vermont's environmental history. He's the creator of the Mountaintop Manifesto, the Mountain Manifesto, http://mountainmanifesto.org, and his article, The Road to Paradise Lost, The Defeat of the Green Mountain Parkway, appeared in the Bennington Museum's Walloon Sack Review. His two-part series, History of Vermont Environmentalism, was published in the Review's spring and autumn 2017 editions. He also wrote an environmental problems in the former Soviet Union for the Johns Hopkins University's SAIS Review, and the New York Times published his letter on the effects of oil extraction in Western North Dakota. Bruce served on the Vermont State Board of Libraries for 11 years, including 9 years as chair. He was also on the board of Rokeby Museum on the Green Mountain Club's History and Archives Committee. So first off, thank you for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being in the program.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So today we were going to talk about a lost opportunity in Vermont. But before we get there, let's give some context for this lost opportunity. And can you give like a one sentence or two sentence teaser on the lost opportunity, and then from there go into Vermont's environmental history over the last couple hundred years?
Well, I'll give a quick teaser. Vermont is not what it seems. You would think that a state that advertises itself as an environmental Oz would have embraced a traditional national park, but it didn't. And we'll talk about why.
Okay, so let's give the context for that. Let's start, I don't know, say 1750.
Well, I want to say one thing first, Derek. Want to take you down a trip down memory lane, because on April 21st, 2009, 13 years ago, almost to the day that we're doing this, you were out here in Vermont. You spoke at the University of Vermont in the Ira Allen Chapel, I guess, to a packed house. My wife was there with our daughter. I watched the end of it on television. I couldn't make it. And if you climbed up the bell tower at Ira Allen Chapel in the daylight, you'd see a magnificent view to the west, beautiful, beautiful mountains across Lake Champlain. Lake Champlain, a azure blue lake. And if you look to the east, you'd see Mount Mansfield, our tallest mountain, and Campbell's Hump, the only 4,000-foot mountain in Vermont that hasn't been spoiled by ski area sprawl. On the surface, things look great. But as you start to peer beneath the shine of that view, you'll find things that are disturbing. And of course, those disturbances began early in about 1760. There were, they estimate, about 1,000 largely English settlers in Vermont. We had indigenous people, largely the Abenaki people and their different groupings. They were largely wanderers. They weren't settled agriculturalists as in southern New England. But then all of a sudden, these English settlers came up. And from about 1760, with 1,000 people, by 1791, our population had grown to, let me see, I have it here somewhere, probably about 85,000 people. And then 10 years later, 95. And then by 1810, about 215,000 English settlers and other settlers came into Vermont. It was said at the time by one environment historian that's written on Vermont that when they got up here, they saw what he called an aristocracy of hardwoods. And there were, beech and maples. They had some ash, oak, and it was largely the pre-settlement forest. And what did they do when they got up here? They took out their axes, they sharpened them, and they started cutting them down. And the more people that came up, there was this land hunger. They settled in the mountains largely, and they began chopping down trees and burning trees. The English crown had its eye on Vermont's forests for many years because they needed tall trees for their masts, for their navy, and for the booms on their ships. And Vermont had a lot of white pine, which in those days stood very, very tall, almost 200 feet, and largely branchless for a good part, beautiful. So surveyors went throughout the woods of Vermont, the forest of Vermont, and put a blaze on those trees. They called it the King's Arrow, three swatches of an axe. And it said, stay away from these trees. They're bound for the king in England to help extend our empire. Well, those trees went down pretty fast, but Vermont farmers took down many trees as well. So what was essentially a forested state, mountainous state, by the around 1820, 1825 had started playing out, losing a lot of its wildlife. And at one point we had stripped away roughly 80% of the forests of Vermont. Some of the summits we didn't handle, and because it was too high, they didn't have the equipment and around some of the wetlands. But Vermont was a mess. You know, James Fenimore Cooper wrote the Leather Stocking Tales, and one of the things he said was, what will the axemen do when they have cut their way from sea to sea? Well, here in Vermont, the axemen cut their way from Massachusetts north to the Canadian border, about 150 miles north from Massachusetts, and they cut from the Connecticut River to Lake Champlain and the western extent of Vermont and did all this kind of damage. And it had quite an effect. As a matter of fact, it generated the attention of a fellow named George Perkins Marsh. I imagine you're familiar with Marsh, Derek. He was from Woodstock, Vermont. He wrote the book Man and Nature, about how humankind has disturbed nature throughout the world. He had seen it right at hand in Woodstock being brought up, denuded hillsides. He had seen it in the Mideast. He had seen it in Italy. And he went to the Rutland County Fair in 1847 and made a speech warning about what would happen. And it's a great case study of what happens when you damage high altitude environments in an area where it's largely treed. For the first few years, the farmers were sitting pretty. They, believe it or not, Vermont was a wheat exporter, which I found very interesting and shocking. We used to live in North Dakota. My wife's family farm, we owned part of it. Wheat was grown on it. We've preserved some in conservation reserve. I never thought of Vermont as a wheat exporter, but it was. Well, it could only do that for a little while because you took away the trees. The soil was full of humus, which helped support that crop. But eventually, you took off what we call the forest sponge, and things washed downhill into the rivers. And it was feast or famine for the mills that they started to build. When it was rainy season, yeah, you could get some water, but many times you got floods. And in the summertime, there was no water to be had for a lot of the mills because that forest sponge was gone, the water was squeezed out of it, and we had dry hillsides. So that was the story of early Vermont. Stuart Udall, who had been Interior Secretary under John F. Kennedy wrote a book, and in it, and this, you know, people that have images of Vermont probably would find this unbelievable. He said, not even in the cotton and tobacco belt were soils exhausted faster and forests mangled more thoroughly than on the hillsides of Vermont. And as a result, they lost the trees. They lost a good part of the timber industry. They burnt a lot of those trees to make potash, which is used in producing wool, and they've shipped that back to England and soaps. And Vermont became a sheep grazing state. And those sheep farms had to be large. They were less labor intensive than putting in crops and cutting down trees. So there were fewer jobs in the hills. Vermonters started going west, leaving Vermont behind because there weren't jobs. Young people, as they, sons particularly, when they became 21, found they maybe didn't have anything to take over, and they left. And it's sort of funny, and that's not funny, it's tragic in a way. Many of these Vermonters went to Michigan, and I think they started cutting down trees when they got there. So that's the, I call that period the period of settlement and spoil. And the next period I call the Great Twilight, with so many Vermonters leaving the state. In 1860, for instance, 42% of native Vermonters, people born in Vermont, were living elsewhere, west, south, north, and sometimes across the ocean. And the sheep had also gone into decline in the wool industry. So we turned to dairy, which is rather iconic here in Vermont. But we just sort of bumped along. We lost a little bit of population. And only after the turn of the century, in the early 20th century, in the early 1900s, was the alarm raised by political officials in the state that we have to do something, and we have to start planting trees, we have to start conserving our water resources, or else Vermont will be a mess. So that's the what I call the Great Twilight. And that began to end as we approached the 1920s and 1930s. So that's answering your question. I hope I covered what you wanted and gave a picture of what Vermont was like during that period.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. Yeah, I like that a lot. So let's move forward. Are we ready for the proposal yet, or is there more we want to talk about before?
Well, the proposal for a national park. Well, it had been there had been several proposals made in the early 20th century by a guy named Joseph Battelle, who owns most of the lands east of Middlebury, Vermont. He owned 30,000 acres. He had proposed a small national park. There had been other proposals that came along, but the main proposal for a Green Mountain National Park didn't really occur until around 1933. But one other thing that was going on, and it's going to play a role in the eventual rejection of this national park. Can you imagine, you know, Vermont rejecting a national park? Well, it did. But one of the things that began to happen in the 1925 period was we had a eugenics movement. It was based at the University of Vermont. And there was this concern among the old Yankees that they were losing what they called the old stock. Vermont had almost an Aryan, obviously, complexion of Old English, and many of them were going. They were being replaced by French. They were being replaced by Irish. They were being replaced by Italians, who weren't favored by the old English settlers. So they wanted to know, what can we do to preserve this old stock? And also they were concerned that these poor people and Catholics and Italians and Abenakis or Abnakis genetically inferior. And Vermont eventually approved the sterilization law in 1931. And this was the environment in which the park proposal came about. But not all was bad in Vermont. In 1931, there was a report called Rural Vermont, a program for the future. It was an outgrowth of the eugenics movement, but it embodied some very significant proposals for improving Vermont itself. And one of those was creation of recreational opportunities and even building roadways high up in the mountains so tourists could get a beautiful view of Vermont if they came forward. So that was proposed in 1931. And so that takes us up to the period of the New Deal, Franklin Delano Roosevelt coming to office, and a proposal made in 1933 for a national park road in Vermont.
Great. So let's move forward with that proposal.
Okay. There. Have you ever been to Grand Central Station in New York City?
Yes, I have, as a matter of fact.
Okay. Well, that Grand Central for a while was a pretty polluting railroad station in Vermont. I mean, in New York City. But a fellow named William Wilgus, who was an engineer, came along. And he proposed sinking the tracks down beneath the roadways and making it more efficient. Well, this was evidently a brilliant idea. Well, Wilgus had ancestors in Vermont. And in 1933, with the Depression raging, but a new president with new ideas, Wilgus made a proposal, and he said, let's get our hands on some of this federal money that's going about. You know, we see excitement now over the ARPA funds that are being distributed to states because of the pandemic. Well, there was a pandemic of unemployment in the late 29 period into the early 30s and mid 30s. So Wilgus proposed a national park road, initially high up in the mountains of Vermont, going from the Massachusetts border all the way up to Canada. And that idea landed like a thud with the Green Mountain Club. Now, folks may be familiar with the Appalachian Trail, which goes from Georgia all the way up to Maine, but we're familiar with a trail that predated that, now called the Long Trail, that goes from the Massachusetts border all the way up to the Canadian border. And in 1910, a teacher in Vermont named James Taylor, he taught at a private school, was up on Stratton Mountain in southern Vermont, and he had this vision for a hiking trail the length of Vermont. And they formed a club called the Green Mountain Club. And in the 1930s, that club was dominated by wealthy people, largely. The board was, and they were dominated by the Proctor clan, who owned the Vermont Marble Company, which was a big extractive industry. Well, they objected to this idea that Wilgus had of building a trail up high, because they felt it would interfere with the Long Trail, and they didn't want that kind of interference from road traffic up on mountaintops. And so their initial reaction was negative. However, within a few days, Wilgus in the papers, it was reported, came out and said, wait a minute, I only drew a quick little finger to use my use the pencil to draw a conceptual outline of what that road would be like. But I'm certainly happy to envision a different kind of road that doesn't damage the mountains and it doesn't interfere with the long trail. And Mortimer Proctor, who was a scion of the Proctor family and then was president of the Green Mountain Club, he later became a governor. He said, boy, if we can achieve this, we would have no objections to this, what became known as the Green Mountain Parkway. You know, you've seen and heard other national park roads, the Going to the Sun Road in Glacier National Park. Shenandoah has its Skyline Drive. You have the Blue Ridge Parkway that goes down from Virginia into North Carolina and parts of Tennessee. Well, this was going to be a version of it, but not necessarily identical to it. So people sort of had discussions back and forth. And then Wilgus went to Washington to drum up support for it. And the Interior Department, run by Harold Ickes under FDR, became interested in the idea. And finally, a decision was made to send up a crew from the National Park Service to make a conceptual survey of a reconnaissance survey of a Green Mountain Parkway. Now, it wasn't only a parkway. Initially, that's all Wilgus wanted, but eventually he considered that the parkway would just be part of essentially a 1 million acre national park. Now, Vermont has 6 million acres, but it would have essentially preserved the entire Green Mountain Range, again, from Massachusetts to Canada. And it would have been one of the largest national parks in the lower 48. And I predict, or I speculate, that because it was so close to the metropolitan areas of the Northeast and also Canada, it might have become the most visited national park in the United States, the way the Green and the Great Smoky National Park is right now. So they sent these surveyors and landscape architects up. It's interesting and a bit ironic in a way that the primary landscape architect was a guy named Laurie Davidson Cox. He was at the School of Forestry in Syracuse University, the New York State School of Forestry. He started their landscape architecture department. And he went to Harvard in their program that they had there that was started in the early 1900s. He also knew Roosevelt. FDR, the School of Forestry, did a lot of work for FDR before he even became governor of New York. They worked on the forests around his place, trying to exercise some wise management. So Laurie Cox knew FDR. The other thing, even though Laurie Cox was coming out from Syracuse, he actually went to high school in Vermont, Bellows Falls, Vermont, from which he graduated around 1900, 1898, something like that. So he knew Vermont. You know, it's funny, Derek, Bellows Falls is on the Connecticut River. And right across from Bellows Falls is Walpole, New Hampshire, where Ken Burns lives, the great documentarian. You may have seen Ken's series on the national parks, America's Greatest Idea. Well, if we had adopted this or approved this Green Mountain National Park, Ken Burns could have driven just a few miles right across the Connecticut River, gone up into the hills, and have told the story of the Green Mountain National Park. Of course, that park never came to be. So he spent a lot of time concentrating on other national parks, including the Great Smokies. So that's how, those are the early days of this proposal for a national park and also for an accompanying parkway. And I'll add one other thing. FDR and the New Deal employed many landscape architects on park projects throughout the country, local parks, state parks, and national parks. As a matter of fact, I think this is the 200th anniversary year of the birth of Frederick Law Olmsted, who created Central Park and other parks throughout the country.
In the 1980s, early like 1982, I saw John Lee Hooker, the famous blues guy, at Chautauqua Park in Boulder, Colorado. And the Chautauqua Park had been set up and the Chautauqua building had been set up in that same era. That was some of the you mentioned all these local parks and everything. There were all of these, the whole series of Chautauqua set up all over. So that was a part of my college experience.
There you go. Well, you know, I have a friend from Springfield, Massachusetts. He did Forest Park down there. But one of the things that came out of that, his park movement, was he wanted to build a carriage road, because they didn't have automobiles then, to go from Grand Central Park to Prospect Park in Brooklyn, which I understand is a beautiful park. And then when the automobile came, they had a regional planning agency or authority in the New York metropolitan area, and they talked about building park roads. One of those was the Bronx River Parkway, which, and parkway's important. It wasn't called highway or expressway. It was called a parkway. It was to be sensitive to the environment in which they were putting in a road. And it was also to clean up horrible polluting conditions along the Bronx River in that part of the New York metropolitan area, because people would live in their tenements and all their crap literally would go into the waters. So the Bronx River Parkway, I find it hard to believe today, if you ever drive on it, it's very crowded, was part of a reform movement. And it was also, there was this concept of what they called the longitudinal park that would be closer to the road, a band that would go east, west, north, south. And this was part of the idea originally behind the Wilgus proposal, that this Green Mountain Parkway and National Park would be have a right-of-way of 1,000 feet. It would have horse trails and another hiking trail. It would broaden out in certain ecologically significant areas, like certain mountains, and bulge out and take in more acreage. Folks thought it could become a larger national park. And Cox set out in early March of 1934 to conduct a reconnaissance survey from Massachusetts all the way up to the Canadian border, largely stopped at Jay Peak, which is state property. It was undeveloped at the time. Now it's a massive ski area, and we could talk about consequences later on. And what Cox did was extremely important. And most people don't know this. Cox proposed, no, we're not going to build a parkway high up on the ridgelines of the Green Mountains. And he did it for a variety of reasons, some ecological, others because it was a theory of landscape designed to offer many experiences for those who might want to hike along the parkway, or obviously drive along, because the car was becoming more and more used in this period. And so Cox said, let's move it off. And that's essentially what he did. You will hear a comment, and or in Vermont, you will often hear that the parkway was going to be built on the spine of the Green Mountains. And people say, well, you know, who would want that? Matter of fact, when I first heard about it, I thought, well, that's a dumb idea. I would never have supported it. But Cox didn't move it there. But people still persist in this myth. It's been peddled by a retired professor who has said that every square inch of asphalt would have been above 2,500 feet, which is wrong. And it's impossible geologically because the way the mountains are in Vermont. But this myth has persisted for a long time. And what I've done with my research and my presentations is show that it wasn't planned that way. It would have been a lot different than, for instance, Skyline Drive in the Shenandoah National Park. Have you ever been there?
I have only driven through that region on the way to do talks, or also as a tourist when I was a kid.
Well, I used to work in Washington, D.C., and I'd head out to Shenandoah National Park. It was about 80 miles away. I used to like go hiking and camping up there. I loved going there when the leaves were down because you could see a lot more. But there was a road right up on the top, right on the crest of those mountains. It was controversial in a way. It led to a big fight between Benton McKay, who was the visionary behind the Appalachian Trail, and a guy named Morton Avery, who was head of the, the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club, who was pushing it. And McKay said, oh, I don't think like it way up here. McKay eventually wrote an article for Appalachia Magazine, I think. And he talked about building a crest line road, not a skyline road, taking the road off of the higher peaks, moving it onto the flanks and even into the valleys, and then leave the hiking and the camping to those who are serious hikers and serious campers. And he wrote that article in, I think it came out around 33, 34. And when they had a meeting here in Vermont in July of 34, they were debating this, and they saw that the plan Cox was coming up with was conforming to McKay's idea of a flank line road. So Cox went forward with his plan, and he completed the original draft of the reconnaissance survey in October of 1934. I have a picture of him up on Jay Peak. There was snow on the ground then. Foliage, the Vermont's famous fall foliage, was at its peak. But he was up there with one of his assistants and two very notable people, T.C. Vint, who was director of planning for the National Parks, and John Nolan, who was a very internationally famous landscape architect. So you had some very prominent people, sensitive people, trying to do something, what I think, good for the Green Mountains of Vermont. It's an interesting role that the Green Mountain Club plays. I'm a member of the Green Mountain Club. In early August of 34, with Cox still in the woods, they put out a poll of its members. I think they may have been around 1,000 at the time. Now there's about 10,000. And they gave a list of pros and cons for building this national park and this parkway. And they asked everybody to send back their responses within 6 days. It was sort of interesting, though. If you understand some cognitive science, usually you believe the first thing you see. Well, they had a bunch of questions, and they listed all the cons first. And they were short sentences where all the pros came after the cons, and they were long, took time to study. So I thought that the questionnaire was a little skewed. But despite that, the early returns showed that, yes, out-of-state members of the Green Mountain Club were against the parkway in a large percentage. But the homegrown people, the Vermonters who belonged to the Green Mountain Club and responded to the questionnaire, actually favored the parkway. And that got onto the papers, and the club didn't announce results for another month. And then all of a sudden, even Vermonters opposed it, and the vote totals changed. And I always wonder, I can't prove it, if the club leadership stacked the deck against the parkway or stuffed the ballots. It was an interesting thing. So much debate went on over the parkway in 1935 in the legislature. The House would defeat it, the Senate would approve it. Eventually, they arrived at the idea of a referendum. You've probably heard of about Vermont's town meeting tradition. So they put an item on the ballot in March 3rd, I think, 1936, that basically would tell the legislature what to do with this Green Mountain Parkway and National Park. And it went down. It was expected to pass. It went down by a large margin, and the legislature eventually repealed the act that would have created the parkway, and that was it for that particular proposal. There was another coming within a year. But one of the interesting things, when I started studying the parkway, reading about the parkway, as I told you, I thought it was a dumb idea. I could not understand why James Taylor, the founder of the Green Mountain Club, would propose desecrating the mountains. Okay. And so then towards the end of my employed work, I started reading more about the parkway. And I was on the Board of Libraries, you said, and I read in a book that then Lieutenant Governor George Aiken, who then became governor later and a longtime senator, nationally known, Aiken had an exchange of letters with a proponent of the parkway who was a progressive minister in Lamoille County, which is near Stowe, the big ski area. And Aiken said, Aiken was running for governor. It was thought that the parkway and park would pass. So he was equivocating. He said, I don't think the parkway will do the damage the opponents say. I don't think it'll do the benefits that the proponents would say. If I lived in Lamoille County like you, I would be for it. And then he went on to say, and this is interesting, I happen to be from Windham County, where hundreds of out-of-state families have come in and bought farms for homes, either summer or permanent. These people are almost unanimously opposed to the parkway, claiming that it would cause the Green Mountains to go the way of the Catskills, bringing in the class of people they come to Vermont to get away from. And I read that and immediately, I mean, I won't say what I said. We shouldn't do it over public airways or anything, but holy cow, let me say that. And I said, this changes everything for me, because what were the Catskills known as? The Jewish Alps. And these folks down in southern Vermont who went to Windham County, where Aiken lived, had come to Vermont to get away from the Jews who were going to the Catskills, and recognize that the Jewish immigrants that came in to this country in the late 1800s and the early 1900s were largely poor. They settled in tenements in New York City, Philadelphia, Boston, other places. And those tenements were horrible places to live. They were hot and crowded. So they would go out to find a hotel, and nobody would let the Jews stay there. So there were farmers in the Catskills, the Jewish Agricultural League, and they started taking people in, you know, early bed and breakfast. They eventually built these inns where people would stay, and Jews found respite in the Catskills of New York. And so Vermont was afraid that Jews would come to Vermont if they build this parkway. It's interesting to note that Roosevelt had conceived of a national mountain parkway from Georgia all the way up to Maine. And there were plans afoot to bring up, to build something called the Berkshire Hills Parkway in western Massachusetts that would join up maybe with the Taconic that comes north from New York City. And there was this great fear that Jews would come to Vermont, establish hotels, and frequent these facilities. So in part, and Aiken later admitted this, that in part this national parkway went down because of anti-Semitism. And it's rather disgusting in a way, because the Green Mountain Club and its publications would publish letters of people mostly against the parkway. And one of the things they were objecting to were hot dog stands. And they'd spell sometimes hot dog, H-O-T-T-E and D-O-G-G-E. Well, what was it about hot dogs that they were afraid of? And then they also said we would have these interior Coney Islands, which was a big frightening thing. Well, those Jewish immigrants in New York City found respite on Coney Island. And they were trying to discriminate against them there, but an immigrant named Nathan Handwerker invented an American version of the sausage, which he called a hot dog. Nathan's famous. And so you had these dog whistles. I didn't know what a dog whistle is until I began doing this research. One famous professor at Norwich University, when I went, said he could not understand it. If an intelligent Vermonter would want to run the risk of creating in Vermont conditions similar to those in the Catskills, at certain beaches in the coast of Maine, and certain localities in the White Mountains. And these were all places where Jewish people would want to go to recreate in the summer. And my son said, well, Dad, that's a dog whistle. And I said, what's a dog whistle? And he said, you know, this message that is intended only for some who can hear it and understand it. And this was part of the opposition to the Green Mountain Parkway and National Park. And so it wasn't built. But within a year, yeah, go ahead.
Well, a couple things. A few things. One of them is that this is all really interesting. Next is that explains why you brought up the eugenics stuff earlier, too. Yeah. And then the third thing is, unfortunately, we only have like 5 or 6 minutes left. So can you move toward the ultimate failure of the park and then the consequences? Because I really want to get to the consequences too. And I'm okay. So sorry, because this is so fascinating.
Well, just to say it very quickly, FDR proposed the National Park in 1937. Another Green Mountain National Park. It would have been built in national forest land largely. It went down. Legislation was introduced in the Congress, but I think it went down largely because of the war coming on, but also because the state forester, who was a big opponent of the national park, built the first ski towers on Mount Mansfield, which was state land. And that's that old forester versus park kind of debate. Gifford Pinchot versus John Muir. So Vermont lost again. So what's happened? Okay. Something happened in the 1950s and called the Interstate Highway System. And all of a sudden, swords were transformed into plowshares, Jeeps into automobiles, tanks into bulldozers. Dynamite was being used to blow up the Vermont environment to build these interstate highways. And what happened was the ski areas started developing, and downcountry real estate hucksters were selling properties throughout the mountains of Vermont, second homes, poorly built, and to entice people to come to Vermont to build in these mountains. And what's happened since then, Derek, is we have some massive ski areas, but many of them, skiing is a sideline, a sideline. They're actually, I call it ski sprawl, sprawling massive homes, condominiums, golf courses. At Jay Peak, we have an indoor water park where you can go surfing. In Okemo Mountain, another ski area, you have something called the Timber Ripper, which is a mountainside roller coaster. We have roller coasters. We have water parks. We have sprawling developments in our high altitude terrain that wouldn't have been there if the Green Mountain National Park had gone through, and particularly if it had gone through its expansive dimension of a million acres. And folks say, well, geez, what would happen to all that business? Well, you know, the national parks promote a lot of visitation. You know, when Obama closed down the parks in a budget dispute with the Republicans when he was president, some of the people screaming the loudest about closing the national parks were these Tea Party guys, right-wing Republicans, who knew that the national parks were popular in their, many of them had national parks in their districts. So Vermont now is constantly fighting the impulse for development in the mountains, relaxing our environmental laws to permit more housing, more ski development. And I think that's part of the legacy of the defeat of the Green Mountain Parkway. Harvard Business School does these case studies. Well, some environmental school could do a case study of what happens when you turn down a national park and you have a big population base. What happens to the quality of the environment, the mountain environment, in the absence of the protection offered by a national park?
The reason I'm not responding is because I'm just thinking about you really brought it all home the last couple minutes with all of those ski resorts / indoor water parks and everything else that this could have been prevented, and there would be that many more acres of, you know, you and I have had discussions recently about what words do we use to describe a healthy, functioning, mature forest. And you know, but what we can say, no matter what language we agree or disagree to use, we can agree that a healthy, reasonably mature forest mosaic of different species is more ecologically desirable by far than a Timber Ripper, I believe the name was, roller coaster on the side of a mountain that is not going to make any bears or martens or fisher or falcons or anybody else very happy.
And don't forget another thing that's happening, wind turbines. And the National Forest Service built the first big wind turbine plantation here in Vermont in the Deerfield Range. And they said they would, it was great habitat for bears, particularly beech. So they mitigated, says, well, we'll preserve land up on the backside of Stratton Mountain, and the bears can go there. So we have a movement here, a great group called Standing Trees Vermont. I think Michael Kellett has been with them, that forester, you know. He has proposed 10 national parks for the nation, and including another try at a Green Mountain National Park, converting our national forest into a national park. I think it's a great idea.
So I guess that's what I would like to end on is I love that idea. And can you, what if anybody thinks that's a good idea, what can they do to, even in any small way, start to promote that?
Well, I think two ways. I want to give a shout out to Standing Trees Vermont, and I think they have a website and they could learn more about it down there. It's a fledgling organization. Another person you know I want to give a shout out to is Annette Smith of Vermonters for a Clean Environment. People should learn more about that. She's been helping fighting destruction of mountains for wind turbines. And it's interesting. These are both organizations with shoestring budgets. The large environmental groups, I call ersatz environmental groups, meaning inferior or replacement, they're promoting renewable energy. They have supported mountaintop destruction. So it's funny, we're going back to our roots in the early environmental movement when we didn't have well-funded environmental groups, but we had great commitment to the environment and great sensitivity to it. And I see that embodied in Standing Trees Vermont and Vermonters for a Clean Environment.
Well, that would be a wonderful note to end on, but, and I know we're running out of time, but there's one more thing that I want to bring up and I'd like for you to comment on, which is something I've always thought is that, yes, we need to protect endangered species, but the time to protect species is really when they're still common and the first danger signs are seen. And this park is such a great example of that. Of Vermont has been so much more trashed in the past 90 years, and the real time to protect it was then, which doesn't mean we shouldn't protect it now, but just how much more beautiful and fecund a region can be if there is protection made when there is still a lot left. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, well, you know, we're starting to see warning signs about, like, the hermit thrush, Vermont state bird, partly because of global warming and partly because of forest fragmentation and losing habitat. The Bicknell's thrush is an upper mountain bird, smaller range, that's in decline. Things are happening there. And these high altitudes, they're thinking, will become lifeboats for flora and fauna as the earth heats. And they're going to be coming up there and they're going to be competing with humankind's activities on the tops of these peaks, which are ecologically sensitive. And I think we need to fight that stuff. And unfortunately, damage has been done, but we don't have to allow it to continue. And we can restore some of our precious lands. I'll leave you with this one thing. I used to belong to the Sierra Club, no more. The Vermont Sierra Club 25, 30 years ago had a bumper sticker, restore our wild green mountains. And now they support wind turbines in those mountains and they say they can be tourist attractions. Now, how crazy is that?
Well, thank you for all of that. And thank you for your great work in the world and for your many years of friendship. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Bruce Post. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.